WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, very Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us, sir. How are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk. It is your President's Day edition. And we have a fantastic show for you. I don't know why I say that, but I must convince you each and every time I get on the mic that it's going to be a fantastic show because, gosh darn it, it's going to be. And hopefully you did something constructive if you had the day off. We have a great show, as they said. Starting things off, he's already here. Actually, my first hour is already here, lined up. Can't wait to get on the mic. Right now we have Ken Sweezy just kind of hanging out, waiting for his turn after traffic. Ken Sweezy is a candidate for the state rep race in the 6th Plymouth District. Thank you for coming in, Ken.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Looking forward to having a great conversation with you.
Absolutely.
Okay. And so we also have following Ken will be Newbie Rateau. Newbie is an award-winning filmmaker. He is here to promote his new film, world premiere coming up on March 24th. It's called I Am You. And you're probably saying, that's an interesting title. Well, this is about immigration in America. So we'll talk with Newbie. And joining Newbie, he has one of the stars of this particular film, one of the main discussion points in the film, a gentleman named Carlito Weaver. He'll be here as well to talk about this film, I Am You. And if you, again, Newbie has actually won an Emmy. That's what I'm talking about, you pointing at him through the glass as he's looking at me. Newbie has won one for his films that touch upon different issues, issues that are important, that are timely issues. We'll talk about that, find out where he came up with the idea to do this one in regards to immigration. And what he's looking for as far as an audience reaction. So can't wait for that. Hour number two. I'm going to speak with Tessa West. Now, if you're somebody who tunes in Monday through Friday to the South Shore's Morning News with Rob Hackler, who is the host and executive producer of that show, just a quick nod, he's also the program director for 95.9 WATD and WBMS 1460 AM. But Tessa West is an author who was on with Rob, I want to say about 3-4 weeks ago. I thought that the conversation was so interesting that Rob and I should have a chance at having an expanded conversation about jerks at work. That's the name of the book, Jerks at Work. We've all had to deal with individuals who you work with, toxic coworkers, and what to do about them. Now, Tessa actually is an associate professor of psychology at New York University, and she also writes regularly about some of her research for the Wall Street Journal. So, looking forward to talking with her and how to be able to deal. Now, the world has vastly changed since COVID, so I will ask questions in regards to, okay, well, what about a COVID world? Is that really changed and shaken up the workplace? Or do you still have these difficult individuals that you have to work with? We all work with some interesting people, and I'm sure that she's going to have answers as to how to better navigate the workplace when you're dealing with a difficult individual. Then we're going to close the show out with a political note. as we have Diana DeZoglio. She is a state senator serving in the Essex District, and she is a candidate for state auditor. She'll join us and tell us why she will be a good candidate. She's one of, I think, two Democrats that are vying for the state auditor's office, as Suzanne Bump is not seeking another term in office. So that should be a hotly contested race. Last I knew, I don't think there's a Republican that's in that race, but things could change in a moment's notice. So we look forward to that. That's coming up in just a few short minutes.
I am so stressed out. The school, home, bills, government, economy, gas prices, vaccines. It is so hard to get anything done and so stressful. We are all stretched to the max with no end in sight. We're all saying the same thing to one another. This is crazy. I'm not the bringer of bad news. I bring good news. And the good news is we're all in this together. And I actually find comfort in that. So let's all take these stress-relieving, mindful breaths together. Don't change the channel. Shh. Take a breath. I'm inhaling. I'm exhaling. Brennan Smoke Shop. Have a great day.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
All right, welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that moment of relaxation with Jeffrey. It almost reminded me. Actually, a couple of months ago, me and the missus went to the salt caves. Yeah, there are salt caves in Scituate. And they had the same thing with the breathing and the music. And kind of was very reminiscent of that. We are back. And our guest, first up, gentleman who wants you to consider him this fall. First, of course, the primary in September. And then in November, if he is successful, depending on if he's going to have opposition. His name is Ken Sweezy. Ken is a state representative candidate for the 6th Plymouth District, soon to be reconstructed in 2023. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I appreciate you inviting me out and everyone at WATD.
Let's kick things off and just briefly give folks a little bit of a background to who you are.
Sure, yeah. So just me personally, I grew up in Hanson, went to, Indian Head, McQuan, Hanson Middle Schools before going on to BC High. In Dorchester. Throughout that, I was, working at my family business over in Whitman. Many people will recognize Sweezy Fence. Nice to have, signs up on fences all over the South Shore a little bit already. Definitely a good place to start. But doing that before I went on to Loyola University Chicago, I got my bachelor's degree in forensic science and went on to a career in forensic science. I was actually a fingerprint examiner for 4 years in law enforcement and did that before taking a job in a private lab early last year, about May. So that's my professional background, what I was doing for a while, pre-COVID and then into COVID, and now I'm here doing that. So
nice. NCIS Hanson.
Right, based on my life, basically. So.
I love it. Is this your first run for a political office?
Yeah, it's my first run. It's something that, I've always been well-read on, very into. I've done a little bit of volunteering. My family's been involved, in the community and with races, been past donors and things like that. When I was in Illinois, actually, at school, I volunteered a little bit on Bruce Rauner's campaign, which has been the only Republican governor Illinois had in quite a while. So I like to think that gives me, good juju going into a Republican race in Massachusetts. So,
what went into considering a run for state representative? Because again, you there's always choices with, should I stay uber local? Should I get appointed to the finance committee? Should I run for selectman? Should I go for state office? What went into it?
Absolutely. And obviously there's so many things that go into it, right? It's never just one thing, but I think I had a common experience that a lot of people had, in March of 2020 when you had to sit back and reflect on a lot of things once we all got sent home at the beginning of COVID. At the time, like I said, I was a fingerprint examiner for St. Louis Metro Police in Missouri, one of the deadliest cities in the country, most violent. Great city, but, one that has its problems like most. So I was sitting there, and even when I went back, I just noticed that it never really felt the same. You know, you had COVID restrictions, crime, violent crime, and homicide was skyrocketing across the country and also in St. Louis where I was at. And me and my coworkers were, you know, working so hard to try to keep up with it, and it really felt like you were just bailing water, like, out of the Titanic, essentially. You know, it's hard being, you know, one of the good guys feeling like your ship is the one that's going down, right? So rather than being an X's and O's guy, you know, in the trenches doing the casework, you know, I thought I really need to zoom out a little bit, look at that 10,000 foot view, and what are the systems doing, the systems that affect this, right? You know, there's obviously a lot of talk about how policy, politicians, and government affects policing, but it's the same way with everything, right? It's, you know, how are they affecting your business, you know, that my family knows all too well? How are they affecting your kids in school? How are they affecting your livelihood, your life, your right to, you know, speech or to move around, and all those things? COVID, for all of the bad that COVID brought, I think it really brought everything that government does and touches into the forefront, you know, of everyone's mind when we were all sitting at home. You know, 2020 had record engagement, you know, in politics, which I do think is a silver lining. It was good, and it was no different with me. You know, like I said, I was always a little bit involved and well-read, but it was something, how do I affect the most amount of people the best way I can? So when I took the private job back here, you know, I started getting involved. I joined the Hanson Republican Town Committee, which, if you're looking for a way to get involved, and that's Republican or Democrat, your town committees is a great place to start. That's where all your local activists and the people that are really plugged into the situation are going to be at. So I highly recommend that, even if you're unenrolled and you're just looking for a way to get involved. So I did that, and then I did actually get appointed by the Board of Selectmen in Hanson to the Capital Improvements and the Economic Development Committee.
Oh, very nice.
So Economic Development Committee is great. It's been meeting a lot, and there's a lot of work to be done in Hanson and a lot of South Shore towns, but that's something I'm really proud to be a part of, because that's really what a lot of the campaign's going to be about, is economic recovery from the pandemic. But all that to say that, you know, there was a lot of things that went into it, and I saw a state rep as the best way to help the most amount of people at a system level.
I feel that certain issues resonate with all of us. What are the issues that are important to you that are going to ultimately shape your campaign?
Absolutely. My campaign is one, and I tell individuals and groups that my campaign is about people. First and foremost, it's about people, and how the government should not be a burden. People look at government in times of crisis. That's the few times when government should be big. When government should be involved in your life is during crisis. Mm. And we saw the past 2 years how ineffective, and all of the, you know, bad stereotypes and generalizations people have about government, making offhand comments in normal times, what that does practically in crisis if it's not doing what it's supposed to be doing. Government during COVID actually burdened individuals more. It tamped down the economy in our district. It tamped down the economy everywhere in the Commonwealth, the country, but in, you know, the five towns that are in the sixth Plymouth as well. You know, how it can affect policy to hurt your child's ability to get a normal education or an education at all. And when it's not doing it directly, it's kicking the can down the road to unelected bureaucrats to make the decision for them so that their name's not there next to a vote, you know, just as an example for whether to mask kids in school or not and when to stop that. So those are the things: the economic recovery from the pandemic, supporting individuals, workers, small businesses in the district, and making sure that government in general is as least burdensome as possible, and that's making sure that you have authority over yourself, your family, and your business. And that's really what it is.
So I took a peek on your website.
Okay.
And I saw six different issues.
Yep.
Of importance.
Yep.
If you could,
yep,
if you're able to, list the order of importance of each one. So we have public safety.
Yep.
Education.
Yep.
Taxes. Clean water. Government transparency, small business. So if you had to rank those 1 through 6, well, how would you rank them?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, those issues are up there because, one, they're all very important. And
give me your top 10.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And they're all connected, right? So when government's working effectively and it's transparent, it's going to be better suited to solve the other problems. Transparency is a huge issue on Beacon Hill. You know, for example, when people take votes in committees, you can't really see how those committees are voting. You can see their general record on the floor, but sometimes you're having people sponsor bills that just by the numbers, they actually end up voting against these bills that they quote-unquote co-sponsor. So transparency is a big problem on Beacon Hill. That's something that's very important and that traditionally is seen as a center-left issue. It's government transparency. I think that people are really fond of it at the national level, and I don't know why. And the transparency laws are actually very strict on our volunteer electeds, like our select board. Their ethics laws, their open meeting laws, very strict. Mm. They don't apply to the legislature in Massachusetts, and oftentimes. So that's really important. That connects us. The taxes bit connects the most to the economic recovery. So that's certainly important. We have right now a legislature that is actually voting on, whether they call it the surtax or the millionaire's tax. For people that don't know, Massachusetts actually runs billions of dollars in surplus every year in our budget, at least recently. Why is it that there's such a focus to raise taxes when we have a surplus? If anything, taxes should be across the board going down on the individuals and on businesses because we have more money than we care to spend.
Have you ever monitored how many supplemental budgets are voted on during a legislative session?
No, I have not. But the way that they interact with the budget is one that only a public entity could do. Mm-hmm. And any private business would not be able to, and anyone would not be able to get away, with the things that they do with the budget there. Clean water is one that's important. It's one that the select boards have to deal with between infrastructure and some chemicals that are potentially poisonous are one that, selectmen tend to care a lot about. The infrastructure is important. It's outdated. That's something that CARES Act and ARPA should be handling. Is it? It doesn't really seem to be if the select board is still complaining about it, right? Mm. So that's one, again, all connected. The taxes, the transparency, everything. Public safety, that comes from my background. We've seen how important public safety can be. There are calls for service in every single town. I believe in the Commonwealth, but as a general trend across the Commonwealth and the country, calls for service have gone up, and I know they have in all five towns in the district. So, our law enforcement officials need help. We need to make sure that they're fully funded, and that goes for everyone. Our paramedics, our firefighters, their calls for services are going up too, but where is the budget, to help them out, right? And to make sure that they can have the staff, the resources, everything they need to answer that increased call for service. And when there's regulations placed on them, whether we agree or not with the regulations, for example, the law enforcement, the cop reform bill that was passed in 2020, not even getting into the issues of that, you need to make sure that, say, it's training requirements, saying it's this or that, that's got to be picked up by the state. They can't lay these burdens at the feet of municipalities and expect them, when towns are just trying to get through, funding our schools and other essential services, to then be on the hook for state regulations. That's something that really needs to make sure that is funded and picked up by the state, if it's a priority. And I think if it was mandated that all regulations were funded by the state at that level, I think you could actually see that they'd be a lot more cautious before taking out of their piggy bank to pass some regulations.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Mr. Ken Sweezy. He is a candidate for the 6th Plymouth District state rep race, and we're talking about his campaign to hopefully be the next state representative, if the vote is say so. Securing local aid, that's kind of a key for any town, the towns within your given district. It's the key to any success for a state representative. What's your understanding of the communities that you are seeking to serve as to what their needs are, and what are you willing to do to secure that funding?
Yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting about the 6th Plymouth, and just to clarify, like you had mentioned with redistricting that just went on, so the district was previously most of Duxbury with all of Pembroke and Hanson. It's now all of Duxbury with parts of Marshfield, parts of Pembroke, parts of Hanson, and parts of Halifax.
Fun stuff.
Yes. So we went from three towns almost in their entireties to now parts of five. So I don't blame you if you're out there listening right now and it's a little confusing.
Yeah.
If you do go to the Secretary of the Commonwealth website, you can find exactly who you will be voting for in the next election, and I recommend that if you're not sure. But all that to clarify, to say that the district is actually diverse in many ways. Obviously, going from Duxbury and Marshfield, coastal, their priorities are, I've had conversations with officials and residents over there, and some of them do care. Like Marshfield, for example, is a top 10, actually one of the safest, nicest places to live in the country. So they care about a lot of things. Their public safety is important, but they also obviously have seawalls that need to be, you know, kept up to date and monitored so that the coastal areas of those towns are protected. And you go inland, right, to places like Halifax, Hanson, and Pembroke, that's not high on the list, right? So it's an interesting spot because it's very diverse in its, you know, its geography. Socioeconomically, the towns are all very different. You know, they just need different things. Like I said, the water infrastructure is something I think that's pretty universal. I know Duxbury had problems with the chemicals I was mentioning, PFAS chemicals. So the state, if they're going to regulate how much of these chemicals can be in the water, are they providing funding for the testing? We should be getting grants for that. How about filters if we have to close a well down? Or how we can get water to the residents that after the well's closed? Those are the sort of things that could be really important to say Duxbury. But Hanson might just have outdated 80-year-old, 50-year-old pipes, right? So that's a totally different animal, right? And it's recognizing what each town needs and meeting everybody where they are. That's why, you know, my campaign is not a Republican campaign or a Democrat or whatever campaign. You know, I'm meeting with everybody, both sides, people who are nonpartisan officials, people who are, you know, of one party persuasion or the other. There's a lot to get done in the 6th Plymouth. There's a lot that's had the opportunity to get done the last 10 years that hasn't. And I think that's what really needs to change, is really meeting everybody where they are, understanding their issues, not falling into the trap of the, we'll say, quote unquote, like headline issues or headline stories. Like, those are all well and good, and someone needs to legislate with our values. But it's the day-to-day stuff, and you can't lose sight of that, right? These are real people. It's 45,000 people down here in the 6th Plymouth that need a lot of help, these towns. And that's really what we're supposed to be on Beacon Hill doing. So
I will say that constituent services were key during the pandemic. Where do you rank constituent services, and how important is it in your book?
Very, very important. You know, I think people that have already met me or know me kind of can understand how important that's going to be should I be fortunate enough to serve. I'm around, right? I'm a Hanson guy. I'm not, you know, interested in really being much outside the district. I love this area. That's why I'm living here and hoping to represent it. You know, whatever it is that you need, you know, this phone will ring and it'll be answered, right? I know I've heard people say that their phone calls or their emails, you know, may or may not get answered, and I understand, you know, people have stuff going on, but this is the priority. This district is the priority. These people are the priority. You know, I'm going to be around. I'm going to be available. This is everything to me, and this is the goal, right? So constituent services is so important. Obviously, again, legislating is a big piece of it, and you want to make sure you legislate with the will of the people and the values of these communities. But like I said, the campaign's about people, and serving as a representative is about the people too.
We're speaking with Ken Sweezy, a state representative candidate. Just got a couple of minutes left with you, Ken. What has it been like out on the campaign trail? Have you been out there? What has it been like engaging prospective voters?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I was saying, I've already gotten out to, you know, a lot of different things. Unfortunately, the New England weather really precludes you from door knocking this early on with the beautiful snow we've had lately. But yeah, you know, I've been out at, you know, I was just at the wrestling sectionals last week at Marshfield High School talking to, you know, some parents there, and going to, you know, other electeds events and meeting voters who, you know, may have voted for other people in the past, you know, people that they and I'm someone they may not have considered voting for before. The feedback has been really, really good. People are really interested, I think, in someone who's listening. That's what I tell all the groups, all the individuals that, you know, I've fortunately talked to a lot of groups as well, and I just tell them, I am here to listen, right? Like, the representative should be a mouthpiece for the community, I believe, on Beacon Hill. It shouldn't be someone that's, you know, pontificating or legislating from on high or doing whatever the speaker wants. It should be someone that's actually accountable to the people, and I think that's what's so important. People are paying attention. People are excited. People are engaged. People are going to come out to vote, and people are coming to events like they haven't before. Like I said, COVID really brought that out, and a lot of the bad stuff that we see nowadays, like how's a mother like supposed to fill up her tank when she's moving her kids around between sports? How is someone supposed to be confident that their job is going to be there tomorrow when it, you know, they can't even keep up with inflation from week to week, never mind year over year? I mean, these are, again, people that are really, really hurting. These issues have real impact on people, on individuals, businesses, and their children and their families. And, you know, when people are told go to work and do the right thing and work hard and everything will work out because this is America or because this is Massachusetts or because it's Marshfield, Duxbury, Hanson, Pembroke, Halifax, whatever. And that's not the case. That's they get upset. They're frustrated. And I think rightfully so. There's things that need to be fixed, and that's kind of what we're here, and that's what I'm hearing out there, and people are really excited about it.
Well, I appreciate you coming in.
Yeah.
Talking a little bit about your campaign. So much more to ask, but oh, so little time.
Of course.
If folks, maybe there's a question I didn't ask, but they want to reach out to you, they want to find out more about your campaign, how can they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can go to my website for a lot of information. There's also links on there about how to get involved, reach out to us, donate, anything like that. That's going to be sweezyforstaterep.com, which is SWEEZEY for staterep.com.
Is that F-O-R or four?
F-O-R, yes, okay. Yes, .com. You can also email me, ken@sweezyforstaterep.com. We're on Facebook, we're on Instagram. Follow us on there. I post a lot on there to keep you updated about where I'm at, what I'm doing, what I'm thinking, everything like that. So please follow me. The links are on my website, but you can also follow me, find me, Sweezy for State Rep, on both of those.
Well, I thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, again, thank you so much for having me on.
And I'm sure we'll hear more from you in and around the area, and stay in touch.
Yeah, always down for some Monday Night Talk.
Here we go. We're going to step aside, and when we come back, I Am You, new documentary, world premiere, Newbie Rateau, in 2 minutes. You're tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
If you want a drink, that's your business. If you want to stop, that's for Alcoholics Anonymous.
AA is an inclusive fellowship of individuals all around the world. The one thing you need to ask yourself is, am I ready to do something about my drinking problem? For more information, literature, and videos about Alcoholics Anonymous, go to AA.org. To find a meeting near you, call 617-426-9444 or visit aaboston.org.
Go ahead, indulge yourself. Every Wednesday night, tune in to Talk with Francesca and join me for provocative conversation, intriguing stories, and inspiration. So sit back and relax, or be stimulated, or both, because being connected feels good, and who doesn't need more of that these days? Don't miss Talk with Francesca Wednesday nights at 9 on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Are back. Joining us right now, award-winning, do a little technical difficulties here because Newbie can't hear. Can you not hear, Newbie? Anything better? Grab these headphones right here. Grab those ones right there. Bet you those one will work better. Check those ones. Can you hear now? 1, 2, 3. All right, good. Listen, during the production, you know better than anybody. Last thing you want to do is have any problems.
Right again, Kevin.
So,
you ever get tired of being right?
You talked to my missus lately? She might tell you a different story. Joining us is a gentleman who's been in this studio for many different discussions. Today, we're talking a little bit about his newest documentary, I Am You. This is in regards to immigration in America. Also joining him is one of the main voices, one of the main faces in this film, Carlito Weaver.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Welcome to the show, Carlito.
Thank you.
I've always wanted to meet someone named Carlito.
There you go. Today's your day.
Today is my day. Newbie, this is your latest film, which is going to be released on March 24th. I'm also hearing that this thing is almost sold out.
It is sold out.
It is sold out.
It is 110% sold out.
In 6 days.
In 6 days, a record.
Wow.
Can you believe that?
God created the world in 7.
Hey, I think I won.
I have spent a lot of time following your career. As you talk, you tackle different topics like relationships between the police and minorities, sports in the inner city, guns in America, and fatherhood. What went into choosing your newest topic, which examines and explores immigration?
Well, I think it was the climate. and we decided to, we started filming right around 2019. And that's right around, you know, the presidential election. And, you know, listen, that was one of the reasons why the president, former President Trump, got elected, was his big stance on immigration. And, you know, there's a lot of topics around that regarding the immigration issue on the border and, you know, Cajun kids and everything. And the fact of the matter is, you know, we grew up in the city of Brockton, myself, our co-director, Will Carlito, where, you know, this is something where it's not a story that people live, you know, where, you know, Brockton, for the most part, is first-generation immigrants. So this is a situation.
Melting pot.
Yeah, it's a melting pot, you know, and I teach in the city of Lynn, and Lynn, very similar to Brockton, same type of issue. So, like, you know, this is a perfect opportunity to really dive into something that's personal. So we say, you know, let's take a jab at it. If we don't do it now, this is really the perfect time, the perfect climate to do it. And, you know, I think even more now, more than ever, the immigration topic just continues to get to really turn into a huge topic.
So, Carlito, you are one of three key figures in this particular film. Describe the initial conversation that you had, whether it was with Newby or William. Of course, your co-director is in here today, Noob.
He sends you his best, though.
Big hug?
Yes, big hug.
Big Madero hug. What was it like when they came to you and said, listen, we want you to be in this film? Walk us through it.
Yeah, well, actually, kind of went the other way around. This was a relevant topic in terms of immigration, and Newby kind of put on his social media some feelers about, you know, anybody have any interest in stories or any interest of talking about this story when it comes to immigration. And, you know, I shot him a message like, hey, you know, I'd love to chat with you and share my personal experience with the immigration process and in terms of how it affected me and my family. And, you know, from there, you know, we just sat down, had a conversation, and we said, okay, well, let's do it. And so, you know, I'm excited, you know, for the premiere. I think that, you know, for me personally, it's something that's near and dear to my heart because it affected me and my family in so many different ways. However, it kind of motivated me and inspired me to, you know, be in a position that I am today, you know, working in the school system and coaching and things like that.
Hey, you're a counselor at Brockton High School.
Yes, sir.
What's that like?
It's actually very challenging, but it's very rewarding at the same time.
Right.
I'm like a school social worker, so I support students socially and emotionally when they struggle with, you know, difficulties when it comes to their peers, adults, or things that are going on at home. A lot of times I'm providing resources, whether it be access to, you know, food, shelter, or, you know, challenges with like immigration and things like that. So we have a large population of students who may be undocumented, and so they have rights. People who are undocumented have rights. Many people don't think they do, but we have like a whole like department, you know, dedicated to supporting students who may be dealing with issues like that.
Let's talk about who are the couple of the other individuals who are key figures like Carlito in this film.
Well, we have Carlito, you know, huge key figure in the documentary. Really, I'd say probably one of the stars in the documentary. We have Eric Hernandez, who's over in Lynn. Excellent, awesome kid. We have Agnes Gibney, who's in the documentary as well. She's from California. Kevin, I want people to understand this documentary, the goal of the documentary is to accomplish a few things. Number one, it needs to make you uncomfortable. This document will make you very uncomfortable. No matter what political side you are, it will make you uncomfortable.
But don't we need to feel uncomfortable before we feel better?
Oh, it's necessary. You know, pain is temporary, right? So it makes you uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, it's going to provide empathy, which we're lacking a lot. Empathy. I may not agree with you, but I empathize and I feel you, okay? It's also going to provide perspective. So three things. So it's going to make you uncomfortable, empathy, and perspective. Perspective. I may not, you know, see what you're seeing, okay? But let me for one day take a look through your eyes and be empathetic to your situation. So I think what this does is, in those, the three stories between Eric, Agnes, and Carly, and those other stories too,
mm-hmm.
That kind of weaved in it, but their stories are very different in some ways, but also very similar. And I just want people to be able to respect each other. And I think this documentary, number one, I just want to, you know, Carlito to step up and tell his story. I'm not sure if I could do that if I was in this situation, to be quite frank with you.
Yeah, and I actually wanted to ask Carlito that. And again, if you're just tuned in, we are speaking with Newby Rateau, local filmmaker, and Carlito Weaver, who is one of the stars in IMU, Immigration in America, a new film that's going to be a worldwide premiere March 24th. Sometimes it can be difficult to be able to share personal or family struggles. Now, because of the nature of this particular issue, was it easier to share details knowing that so many others have dealt with it, are in a similar situation, or not so much? What was it like for you?
For me, there were times where, you know, it kind of had to take a little bit of break off camera just to kind of, you know, gather the emotions. But I think it's important, right? I think it's important because, you know, without struggle, you can't have progress. And so I kind of use my my story to kind of fuel me to get to where I'm at now. So, like, I grew up, I was very angry. My father was in and out of my life. Wasn't quite sure the reason why he disappeared for long periods of time. As I grew older, you know, I recognized he was being deported multiple times, right? And so when you're a child, you know, they want you to be in a child's place, so you don't ask adult questions like, where's daddy, things like that. And I played football. So I was able to physically exert, you know, some of my anger and frustration in a safe space on the football field. You know, I ended up going to Framingham State for a year, transferring to UMass Amherst, getting a bachelor's degree in economics. I just got my master's from Cambridge College in school adjustment and mental health counseling.
Congrats.
I coach at the high school. And so, like, I can use my story and my struggle as a way to help motivate and inspire others to overcome, you know, challenges that they face in everyday life.
So I would ask you, newbie, you know, the technical side of things, there's always challenges, but were there any key challenges in assembling this particular film?
You know, the biggest challenge for any documentary is getting people together. Here's the mega super challenge that I never thought was going to be in existence, was have a pandemic that we had the first in 100 years. That was a huge obstacle. And to be quite frank with you, Kevin, you know, in March of 2020, I wasn't sure if this documentary was going to be completed at all. I was thinking maybe we should just cancel the project because I didn't see an opportunity to film a documentary. We depend on, you know, a protest or getting natural sound and getting natural events, and all those are canceled. It's like, well, we got a big problem here. So, you know, eventually things did open up. You know, God is good, and, you know, the unfortunate situations that happened, George Floyd. We were able to get some footage and kind of, you know, document some American anger, American culture, and some American perspectives. So we wanted some of that. So, but, you know, things like, you know, recording a football season with the crowd and with the audience, we couldn't do it in the year of 2020. We had to wait till the next year, you know, to get footage of Carlito coaching and things like that and get the B-roll we needed necessary. So that was a huge roadblock, was the pandemic. But ultimately, it was a blessing in disguise. You know, we got an opportunity to really think about how we're going to map out the documentary. And we met some amazing, amazing people. But Kevin, God's honest truth, one of my favorite parts of this documentary is being able to work with my former students who came through my class and now are in college. That meant more to me. Every Sunday we'd shoot, every single Sunday, especially during the pandemic, we'd shoot B-roll. That meant more to me than anything, you know, so... I could take more of that, that experience than, you know, that was more rewarding than even finishing the documentary itself, honestly.
Minting the next award-winning filmmaker?
God willing. Mm-hmm. And hopefully if we get nominated for an Emmy, they'll all be nominated for an Emmy, and I'm hoping that's the case.
Carlito, how important is it that there is an open and honest discussion when it comes to immigration? And ultimately, I was trying to find an equitable solution.
Mm-hmm. I think it's extremely important. I think that the process needs to be more transparent. There's already barriers that prevent immigrants from coming here. A lot of them is like language barriers or cultural and social norms, and trying to figure out how to navigate the system. And so I don't know if there's like caseworkers assigned to immigrants when they are in a situation that can help them, you know, become citizens, that can help them file paperwork that they can regularly check in with, and things of that nature, but also being open to the perspective that people do come here because America is a land of opportunity, right? And so we don't necessarily want to be selfish. Obviously, there's a process, right, and a way that we need to go about things in order to, you know, ensure the safety and the welfare of everybody, but, you know, just kind of be more open-minded and see the other perspective, as Nubi said earlier.
Does it seem like there's a lack of that these days, that there's a lack of perspective from folks to look at this? I mean, we're all, let's be honest, we're all, you know, from immigrant families.
Mm-hmm.
We all are.
Mm-hmm.
So why not let the future, the next generation of immigrants have an opportunity too?
I agree. I think, you know, we went to the California border. We met a border agent named Chris Harris. Agnes Gibney did a great job connecting us. And, you know, I listen, my perspective is a little more liberal. But I did understand a different perspective when I did go to California and saw the border. And I will say that. And, you know, the documentary speaks more about that. But perspective is important. And empathy is important. And going to California, going to that border, you know, I may not agree with everything they're saying in terms of the border agent, but I do respect their perspective. I really do. So, and I think that's, we do a good job accomplishing that, of getting really, truly every side. And my whole thing is, as a documentarian, listen, it's my job, not my job to have an opinion. It's my job to present the facts and the viewers make the opinion.
Well, what are you hoping the viewers will take away from this film?
Well, I'm hoping the viewers will take away that, you know, just because someone disagrees with you doesn't mean that, you know, they're ignorant, doesn't mean that they're racist, doesn't mean that they don't like you. And I want them to understand that, you know, understand and respect other people's opinions. You know, if I'm a dreamer, your dreamer could be your classmate sitting next to you.
Mm.
The dreamer could be, you know, someone who's working just as hard as you, but you don't know their struggle. So you have to empathize with that person. You know, so I think that's important. And vice versa, even in California, you know, one thing, you know, that people were saying in California, on the border agents, was that the gang violence in Los Angeles or in California is a lot more than what it is around here in Boston. So they get a different perspective in terms of, you know, maybe who crosses that border and what have you. But I think it's very important to educate yourself on different issues and to have laws that show empathy. Listen, I don't care what you say. If someone comes here at 3 years old and they don't know nothing but their country that they're in, you got to be able to empathize with that situation. That, you know what, maybe it's not the best idea to send them back to their country. Maybe let's work on ways that they can get citizenship. I think it's very important for us to empathize with people's situations. If someone is in California and someone is affected by maybe crime, by someone who's might have been in the gang, what have you, might have been undocumented, empathize with their situation as well.
Well, I think, like common sense, I think empathy is in short supply these days. Mm. You either have it or you don't. Carlito, have you had a chance to see the film, or have you seen any of the snippets yet?
Yeah, I've had the opportunity to watch it, and I was just telling Nubia, I was like, man, I wish I watched it again. yeah, I did.
What was it like? I mean, to be part of the process, it's like when your grandma's making a cake, you know, she's putting out, you know, whatever it is that, you know, our parents or grandparents have made for us, and watch them put it together, like, that's not going to be any good. And then when you taste it, like, you're like, oh, hey, this is really good, or... I'm okay.
I think Nubi did a great job putting together something that is thought-provoking, right? It's going to stir up emotion, and people are going to have to learn how to be comfortable being uncomfortable. It's going to challenge you to think. You might come in and before you see the documentary with one perspective, and when you walk out, you might feel a completely different way. And, you know, the process was something that I enjoyed from beginning to end. Nubi always made it, and his mentees always made it. So, you know, they were patient. We took multiple takes. I'm not in any way, shape, or form an actor. So, you know, the patience and, you know, the due diligence, right? Nubi was on it. He was on a schedule. You know, we had to be here by this time, kind of got things done. But it was fun, right? And I built relationships with people, and I can't wait to meet. I was telling Nubi, the dreamer, I was like, I never met him, but like, I'm hearing his story, and it's like, I can empathize and I can relate to the young man, you know, and I would love to kind of maybe even be a mentor to him and help him navigate his current process and his struggle.
Okay, and the voice you heard is Carlito Weaver. He is one of the stars of this new film called I Am You, Immigration in America. Nubi, last word, if folks want to, are you going to add showings if folks want to see this and you're adding these showings, where can they go to find out that information?
Right, so we're working on new showings as we speak this week. We're looking to try to have something in April. The information will be on newbeproductions.com, N-O-U-B-E, productions.com. I do want to give a shout out to the Broughton Cultural Council and Lynn Cultural Council. Without their support, the documentary does not exist. So I just want to give them a major shout out. And I want to give you a shout out too, Kevin, because you're my friend.
And I want to thank you for this advanced copy of I Am You. I am looking forward to going home and watching this and putting it on the shelf with the other documentaries that you have hand-delivered to me for me to be able to watch and see what goes into the great mind that has won one Emmy so far.
Yeah.
And soon to be another, and I know that you're also looking to climb the ladder and go for bigger hardware one of these days, and I'm sure it's going to happen with your diligence.
Appreciate you, Kevin.
Well, we appreciate you coming in, and we look forward to a follow-up as to how things are going.
Sounds like a plan to me.
All right.
Thank you, Kevin.
Hour number one is in the book. Hour number two is on deck. I'm going to ask you this question before we come back for you to ponder. Do you have to deal with people in the workplace? We're going to talk with Tessa West. Talk with her about her new book, Jerks at Work. You're tuned in to Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD. Stay tuned.
WATD FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. This is the South Shore's radio station, 95.9 FM WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Each year, about one out of two men and one out of three women will develop cancer. But there's good news. Today's cancer survival odds are much better than two or even 3 years ago. Things move that fast. So if you're diagnosed, be sure to have someone in your corner who is on top of all the latest cancer treatments and techniques, the latest research, the newest equipment, all the newest medicines available through clinical trials. And speaking of corners, here's more good news. Advanced cancer care is now just around the corner. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare treats patients locally, with all oncology services and specialties conveniently housed under one roof. The center is affiliated with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, so you'll be seen by Harvard Medical faculty physicians and oncologists. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare, in affiliation with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Cancer has just met its match. Find out why at mysignaturecare.org/cancercare.
That truck, it pays?
What?
The bumper sticker on that truck says it pays.
Pays? Pays what?
I can't quite read it. Oh, it pays to stay way back.
Ah, what was that?
The truck, snap back or rock. Now I've got a broken windshield.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny and Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. It pays to stay way back. However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Okay, later this hour, we're going to speak with State Senator Diana DeZoglio. She is a candidate for state auditor. But before we get into talking about any state races, first, I want to welcome the one and only Rob Hakala, who's doing double duty here today. As I reached out to him a couple of weeks ago, he had a great guest on, Tessa West. She's an author talking about the workplace. So I want to thank you, Rob, first and foremost, because you're kind of the linchpin to this whole thing.
Great to be here, Kevin. And a good evening to you. It's wonderful to be on Monday Night Talk. And yes, Tessa was amazing. We had such a short time in the morning, as you know, and you reached out and said, boy, can we do an extended dive deeper with Monday Night Talk? Because there's so much to talk about with jerks at work.
And it's funny. I'm fortunate where I wear multiple hats, and I've been a part of so many different workplaces. Rob, you've been a part of different workplaces as well, so I'm sure that you can identify with the book that Tessa put together.
Absolutely, Kevin. I think when you start to go through some of the categories that Tessa will explain, I think you will be able to relate to some of these people. And you're right. I mean, that's part of working in any office is there's a dynamic. And I think what Tessa is going to do is help to kind of navigate our way around some of these characters. And by the way, you may be one of them. Not you, Kevin.
One of our listeners. But who knows? Maybe I might be one of them. Who knows? But let's welcome in Tessa West. Tessa, are you there?
I am. Thanks for having me on, guys.
No, thank you so much for doing a return appearance. Again, my name's Kevin Tocci, and you already know Rob. For folks who don't know who you are, tell us a little bit about yourself. My understanding is that you are a psychologist. You're an associate professor at New York University. And also a writer who does research and shares it with the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, that's probably a better introduction than I could have done. That's right. So I'm a professor at NYU in the psychology department. I study all the awkward ways we interact with each other at work. So how we negotiate and how we tell our boss they're not doing a good job. How we get raises. Mm. How we get people to be honest with us. All those kinds of sticky issues that we deal with at work. If you come to my lab at NYU, you might be stuck in a study having one of those very uncomfortable conversations with someone. And it's great. I get to make a living doing that all day long.
It's fantastic. Well, Rob, I'm going to give you the baton and let you ask the first question.
Well, I thought it'd be great. And Tessa, by the way, thanks for joining us again on WATD, is to kind of, since we have the time to dig a little deeper, is let's get into some of these types maybe. And then Kevin and I can kind of comment on some of the types of jerks at work, toxic coworkers, and what to do about them. Tell us about some of the categories of people.
Yeah, so I tried to break this book up into 7 categories of people. 3 of them are bosses and 4 are coworkers or colleagues that we encounter a lot at work. And it doesn't matter if you are a TaskRabbit employee, or you're a writer or a journalist or a professor, or you cut hair for a living. It really doesn't matter. You're going to come across these different types. So the first type I talk about in my book is the kiss-up, kick-downer. So most of us at work have dealt with this person. They torture everyone who works at the same level as them or those who are beneath them. But the boss absolutely loves them. They kiss up to the boss. They know how to say all the right things when the boss is around. They pretend to be a team player. And they're really hard to beat because they usually have a skill or two that makes them just really difficult to fire. And if you complain, your boss will look at you like you're crazy or accuse you of being, you know, petty and competitive. But those are the types we often see in very competitive work environments.
So go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, so how do you deal with a kiss up or a kiss downer?
You know, we often have this intuition that if you realize you're being bullied at work, you just have to really stand your ground and kind of prove to these people they can't mess with you. But I actually don't think that works so well because they know exactly what they're doing, so they'll just outmaneuver you next time. And the key here is just to get your boss to actually care. And most people, they either assume their boss doesn't care, you know, or they don't even try. It's just too exhausting. So I say for these folks, the first thing you really want to do is actually form a network of allies. You need to find people who know other victims of your kiss-up, kick-downer, maybe have been victimized themselves, or just have heard other kind of grumblings going around in the workplace. And I think often we'd want to go to our best friend to complain and sit at the bar and have drinks and talk about this person, but that's not who I'm talking about. I'm talking about people that you don't even know that well, who've just been around the workplace for a while. They can help you build a story and help you find reasons why your boss should even care about kind of being receptive and change at work. So when you do complain to that boss, it's not just a he said, she said, or this person made me feel bad. It hears all the ways this person is disrupting others at work, and I'm really worried that there's going to be kind of a mass exodus or just, you know, people are really disengaged. And, you know, and here are the strengths this person has, you know, kind of admit that, but then talk about some of the behaviors this other person is doing. And if more people you can bring with you, with your boss, but certainly don't leave with just complaining about them, because I've tried this personally when I worked in sales, when I sold men's shoes, and it just completely backfired. So you really kind of have to lead with some of their strengths and then have strengths in numbers when you do approach your boss.
Tessa, when you do get together with some of your coworkers, and say this kiss up, kiss down person also has friends of theirs, what can you do to prevent this kind of teams thing from building up, where all of a sudden you have factions within? It's a Game of Thrones inside Survivor. The workplace. Yeah, how do you avoid
absolutely.
That?
I mean, that's the biggest hurdle, is figuring out who's actually aligning with your kiss up, kick downer, and who's also been victimized. Sometimes you get victims who just simply don't want anything to do with it. You know, they're kind of just like, this is exhausting, leave me out of it. So the key is how you approach people. You don't want to approach others and complain about your kiss up, kick downer, because you honestly have no idea whose side they're on. What you want to do is ask about what their experiences have been like. And this is also good for a reality check for you, because if you're the only one victimized and nobody else is being victimized, it's really important for you to know. But if you ask it as a neutral question, instead of kind of making a, you know, having gossip about this person, you know, what have your experiences been like with Mark? You know, has he been supportive? Like, any, you know, advice you have on how to have positive interactions, you know, or whatever the issue is. But simply frame it as a question. And don't start with saying, this person treats me horribly, have you had that same experience? That can also backfire if, just for the reasons you guys are getting at, they happen to be aligned with a kiss up, kick downer. And frankly, a lot of people are, because these folks know how to get ahead. They know how to climb the ladder. Sometimes if you just kind of hang out with them, you're able to kind of get a little bit of that as well.
And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Tessa West, and we're talking with her about her book, Jerks at Work. Yeah, it's very blunt. Toxic coworkers and what to do about them. And this is basically a playbook which can help you and assist you in tough times. Would you put the people who like to snitch under the kiss up category?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's this kind of funny thing that happens where people will complain to the boss if they observe other people doing naughty behaviors at work.
Mm-hmm.
Kiss up kick downers do it really systematically, and only in ways that will directly benefit them and won't backfire. So if they are, you know, observing someone stealing at work, but allowing that person to steal actually benefits them, then they'll do nothing. They have to be very careful, you know, when they engage in that kind of behavior, to just do it only when it directly benefits them, because often it can backfire if they get a reputation of, you know, not being a team player. So the one thing about these folks is they're really good at isolating their victims and figuring out who exactly they can kick down and get away with. It's often isolated people, new people, people that don't have a lot of friends. They don't often kind of go after, you know, well-liked, socially visible, well-connected people at work.
Now, talk to us about the credit stealer. Who is that person?
This person's exhausting. So we all know what it feels like to walk into a meeting, have, you know, this awesome contribution, and then someone else just gets credit for it. And who knows if they just did a better job of kind of stating to the boss what that idea was or what. Credit stealers, at least the good ones, tend to be our friends, the people that we confide in, and sometimes even our bosses. And what they do is they manage to get credit for your hard work and for your good ideas. And, you know, full disclosure here, sometimes this is unintentional. It can be really hard to figure out who did what or who said what, especially in workplaces where ideas are thrown around in the air and we kind of all forget who contributed, you know, certain things. But credit stealers are actually really systematic in that, you know, they'll actually grant you credit for things behind your back to, again, kind of like a kiss up, kick down, or make it look like they're a team player. And they do this so that if you accuse them of stealing credit later, you look, you know, either crazy or just irresponsible, not paying attention, jealous. So they can really build a case for why they should get credit for that thing. They're really great at doing this right now, actually, during this kind of working from home situation. When a lot of the work we're doing is what we call invisible labor. No one really sees you do it. It's really hard to prove you're the one that did it. And so they can easily kind of come and swoop in and steal credit for that. Or they just are better able to state your idea in kind of a clear, more concise way, so it sticks to them instead of you.
Tessa, are there sort of these bosses that are mid-level that feel the pressure from people above them so much that they feel that they almost reach out to the people that are below them, always looking for good ideas? Is that kind of one of the strategies that they do to get credit for themselves so they can keep their job?
Absolutely, and I think you kind of actually hit on a hybrid of the credit stealer and the gaslighter. So, you know, bosses that do this a lot and they really try to steal credit, they have to isolate the victims that they do it from so that they don't get caught. And then you kind of end up in a little bit in gaslighter territory where they're isolating, they're creating an alternative narrative so the victims don't kind of find out about it. But we actually do see when the credit stealing, you know, comes from above, that it's often at the mid-level. CEOs aren't stealing credit for, you know, things from the people, you know, in the C-suite. They would just get called out. But mid-level managers are much more likely to do it. And often it's because the people they steal credit from are never going to complain up to levels. They're not going to complain to their boss's boss about it. In fact, they might not even know who that person is or have any chance of even connecting with them. So it's a fairly safe strategy for someone in middle management to do if you don't even have interaction with people who are two levels above you. They simply just won't know it's even happening.
So you were talking management here, and I know Rob brought up mid-management. But let's talk about bosses. What are some of the titles? What are some of the attributes of different bosses or managers that you can give tips about?
So I think the most common one that most of us have dealt with at work is the micromanager.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, this person, it doesn't matter, you know, whether it's the font you're typing in or how you've spaced out your office or something actually important, they have a lot of top-down control over everything you do and everyone. So it doesn't matter, you know, how good a worker someone is or how autonomous they are. One thing that's kind of key with a micromanager is they often demand a lot in a very short period of time. So their turnaround expectancy is crazy, you know, something that's just not reasonable. And the irony of these folks is they work the hardest, and so do the people who work under them, but they actually get the least done. So they kind of mix up time spent on something with progress. And I think these folks are really hard to deal with because a lot of the causes for the micromanagement are actually things that are kind of also happening to them. They're not getting, you know, much guidance on how to actually manage. So most people are actually promoted because they were good at their old job, not because they know how to actually pull back and manage people who now hold their old job. They get no training. They're freaking out about failing, and so they want to make sure everyone's doing everything right so that they don't fail. You know, they're not getting any guidance from above. Or there's what we call too many reporting layers. There's a manager, an assistant manager, an assistant to the assistant manager, and people just run out of things to do, so they end up micromanaging. So I think this is one type of boss that at least I have yet to encounter anyone who's worked for more than 2 years in their life and hasn't dealt with a micromanager. It's just incredibly common at work.
Go ahead, Rob.
Do they get burnt out, though, sometimes, Tessa? I mean, micromanaging can be so difficult. It consumes your time.
Yep.
And it's something where you really just have to work on delegating better to get the bigger picture done.
Yeah, I think it's delegating better, but I also think if you're being micromanaged, there's a couple steps you can take to help, you know, actually help your boss put up some guardrails and also just to realign on goals. So, you know, one thing is, like, how do you approach a micromanager about this? Do you go to them and say, you know, you're smothering me, you need to kind of step back? That usually doesn't work. What actually works is to have a broader conversation about being aligned on where they want you to go and where you see yourself going and exactly what it takes to get there. And I think once you're aligned on those goals, and frankly, that's just a less threatening conversation to have with a micromanager than telling them they can't do their job. You know, I see that you maybe are seeing me going in a place that I don't necessarily want to go. Half the time what you see is that micromanagers feel like they're doing it because they don't completely trust that you're able to get there on your own. So you set those goals together. You have really explicit timelines and, you know, week by week exactly what you need to achieve and when. And then I really recommend, no one likes hearing this, but you need to set frequent, super short meetings with your micromanager to kind of scratch their itch to spy on you. And so instead of these 30-minute long meetings, you need to have, you know, 5-10-minute check-ins every 3 days, something like that, to give them the exact information that they need to kind of feel better about how you're achieving those things. And then explicit rules about mode of communication, can they text or email, and then explicit rules about hours. So I think the one thing is micromanagers are a little bit like kids that don't get their nap. They know they need it. It makes them feel better to actually have some rules placed on them, but they fight it. But once they get it and they're in that routine, then they actually realize they benefit from it too. It's not just you, it's them as well.
What are some of the other boss traits that you've studied and that you've written in the book?
So the other boss I talk a lot about is the neglectful boss, which is kind of the opposite. you know, end the continuum of the micromanager. So this is that person who's completely overworked. They don't know what you do here. You know, you're not getting much guidance from them. But kind of the irony of them is that when they're not neglecting, they actually tend to be micromanaging. So they show up at the 11th hour, you know, right when you're ready to kind of pull the trigger on whatever you're working on at work. And then they freak out because they've been out of control and out of the loop. They micromanage to make themselves feel better, and then they disappear again. So that boss actually creates a lot of uncertainty and anxiety for people because they just have no idea when they're going to show back up and then do this whole, you know, pattern of behavior all over again. And I think especially in the pandemic where we're seeing burnout, you know, super high among especially middle managers, actually, we're seeing a lot of these neglectful bosses that are just kind of jumping from one thing to the next, micromanaging, neglecting, and going back and forth a lot. And then you layer on top of that a problem that I call my book time thieves. So these are those people that will just kind of suck you dry and want to press the flesh and, you know, just want to get to know you or get favors from you. And if your boss is a nice person, they're just going to be completely destroyed by these time thieves and they're never going to have time for you. So half the battle there is actually kind of figuring out if that's happening or not and how to reengage them by sometimes even offering to offload a little bit of their time thief problem and spreading it out among your team.
You know, Tessa, you talked about the dynamic of working from home during this segment. How did the pandemic change the dynamic and working from home and not having to physically interact with some of these characters?
I think it's a really interesting question. I mean, a lot of people ask me, is it better or is it worse? And I would say that dealing with jerks at work, you know, if someone wants to be one of these types or, you know, has a personality to be one of these types, they'll find a way. They don't necessarily have to do it in person. And I think people are clever and they adapt and they figure out what social situations will kind of enable them to get away with their behaviors. And then, you know, you have a kind of a person by situation interaction where if you have a tendency to micromanage and you're really anxious because of the pandemic, you're going to just micromanage more. But if you have a tendency to kind of neglect and you get really anxious, you're going to neglect even more because you're just going to kind of panic and sit on your couch and watch Netflix. So what I actually see in the pandemic is a lot of these tendencies people have actually are exacerbated because they're anxious and they're stressed. And that stuff turns on all of our kind of most insidious behaviors at work. You know, if we have a tendency to free ride, you put the stress of the pandemic in there, they're going to do it even more and they're going to find ways of doing it on Zoom or in person. It doesn't really matter. So I think one of the reasons why we have this great resignation and the number one reason being like people don't want to deal with jerks is just that people have become even worse and more clever. And all of these tendencies have really come out of us because we're stressed and because we're feeling a lot of uncertainty already in life. And that tends to bring out the worst in us at work.
You know, it's interesting. I have to ask you this. You've helped us identify some of these individuals, these archetypes that are in a workplace, whether it's a coworker or dealing with certain bosses. What can one do to make sure, what can one do? Can you give advice in regards to their work environment and making sure it doesn't bleed into their home life?
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. People never believe me when I tell them this data point, but the stress we experience from work affects our home lives and our physiology more than the other way around. You know, more than our home lives affect our stress at work. It's just simply because we spend more time in the workplace than we do at home. And I would say, you know, I've done some interesting research on what we call, you know, trying to suppress stress. So the absolute worst thing you can do is try to grin and bear it and go home and try to push it down and drink that bottle of wine and be nice to your kids. That actually totally backfires. In fact, your kids can, like, pick up your stress and it shows up in their physiology moments later. So suppression doesn't work. I think the best strategies you can do is kind of deal with low-level conflict as soon as it shows up. And use a lot of the same strategies that actually work with our kids and with our spouses in dealing with that conflict and apply them to the workplace. You know, when you have low-level everyday stressors at work, it's going to bleed into home, but you can do small things to help you regulate that stress at work so that it doesn't. You know, for instance, if you have a micromanager, you can do these small things to put barriers in place. Or if you're dealing with a gaslighter, you can do small things to avoid contact with them. You know, even small things like sitting next to your jerk at work instead of across from them in a meeting can do wonders for your blood pressure and stress because you don't have to look at them. You know, these small steps can actually do a lot to actually regulate your emotions and your physiology so that when you do go home, you're not taking it with you. So even if you can't solve those jerk at work problems in the moment, small little things, asking people to buffer you, you know, by sitting in between you, you know, these kinds of small things can actually help a lot. But I think denying it, pushing it down, and trying to just, you know, not allow it to spill over completely backfires. And that's actually the strategy most of us use. That and, like, drinking a lot of alcohol. Those things tend to just not work, at least in the long term.
No, that doesn't work for anyone, usually. Tessa, what about for the people out there? You know, we've talked about navigating around the jerks at work. What about, you know, if you are the jerk, if you are a jerk, can you be empathetic? Can you reflect on yourself? Are there any strategies? Can that person become a better person at work?
Can you
can they not see it?
Can they reform?
Reform.
Yeah, you know, let me just start by saying that I think there aren't good people for the most part. There's not good people and bad people at work. We're all kind of shades of gray, and we all have the potential to be a jerk at work. In fact, I try to just warm people up to this idea in my book by throwing myself under the bus as much as I possibly can, because I have definitely been a jerk at work. I've definitely been a neglectful boss, and I've bulldozed and stuff like that. I think it's normal and natural, and we kind of just need to accept that not all of us are going to be at our best all the time, and that's okay. Here's the thing, though. If you are a jerk at work, don't expect people to tell you. In fact, people don't even tell anyone during exit interviews. They don't even tell their bosses during exit interviews or even, you know, HR that somebody was a jerk at work. We just aren't used to having those kinds of conversations. So don't expect that information to just come flooding at you. I think you have to actually really learn how to ask for feedback in the right way, especially if you're asking for feedback from people who work for you, who you hold power over. And don't ask for, you know, do you think I'm a jerk or do I smother you? Ask about your specific behaviors. What do you want, you know, me to do more of, and what do you want me to do less of? And did it work when I gave you feedback this way or that way? The more specific feedback you ask for, the more often you do it, the more likely you're going to be able to fish out if there's some problems in your behavior at work. And I think most of us just simply don't think we're jerks. In fact, I know this. I have a survey in my book called Are You a Jerk at Work that you can take, and I put it on my website and TessaWestAuthor.com. You can take it and get feedback. And, you know, like 99% of people think they're the ideal coworker. But if I ask them to complete it for a boss or coworker, 1% of people think that their boss or coworker is an ideal person. So we have a huge kind of self-serving bias here. Most of us just simply aren't willing to admit it, and no one's going to tell you. So you have to ask for that feedback. And that's okay. It's okay that you aren't perfect at work. We all have our weaknesses. It's just learning these strategies to kind of mitigate the worst version of you, honestly. What is the worst case scenario version of you, and what brings out that person? And then learn to identify those triggers. You can't often change what brings it out on you, but you can change how you respond to the triggers. So if it's stress and anxiety, and you micromanage, find out what you're going to do instead when you feel stressed or anxious. You know, replace those behaviors with something else. And that can actually really help you kind of move the needle a little bit and just practice this over and over again.
Tessa, Pizza Fridays works for me in the workplace. Pizza Fridays. I think that helps a lot.
Pizza any day helps a lot, for sure.
Yes. And again, we've been talking with Tessa West, a great conversation, talking about her book, Jerks at Work, Toxic Coworkers and What to Do About Them. And Rob Hakala from the South Shore's Morning News, host and executive producer of that radio program, and our program director here at 95.9 WATD, joining me on the Q&A. Tessa, final question, and that is, how can folks, they've been hearing us talk about the book, how can they get the book?
So the book is sold anywhere books are sold. You can go online to TessaWestAuthor.com, and there's a list of all the retailers where you can purchase the book.
Well, we want to thank you again for giving us a second bite at the apple to learn more about ourselves, learn more about our workplace, and what to do if we are either the jerk or dealing with jerks or our boss is a jerk.
Thank you so much.
You got
thank
it.
Thank you, Tessa.
And Rob, I want to thank you for joining me on this conversation as well. It's been fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you, Kevin. It's been great. Have a good night.
You as well. We're going to step aside and on deck, the final conversation of the evening. to speak with State Senator Diana DeZoglio. Talk to her about being the next state auditor, if possible.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
This is Netta Bercoloni with the Friends of the Marshfield Animal Shelter. Join us Saturday, March 5th from 5 to 9 p.m. at the Marshfield Elks for our benefit for the Marshfield Animal Shelter. This is a family-friendly event with music by local favorites, the Leon Street Rockers. For questions or more information, call Vicki at 781-837-9759. Hope to see you there.
There I was in my business suit, all dressed up, just uptight as I could possibly be. And I don't remember much of what was said at that first AA meeting. It was more the feeling of the meeting itself.
What I notice about AA is it sort of helps me to relax and learn to really be happy with my sobriety.
That's exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous does. It teaches us how to live without drinking. It teaches us how to have fun and really enjoy life without drinking.
Visit AA.org for more information and download the Meeting Guide app to find a meeting near you.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
We have returned for the final segment.
Joining us for another conversation, as you know, folks are on the campaign trail. We have the privilege to be speaking with State Senator Diane DeZoglio. She represents the 1st Essex District. Senator, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me, Kevin. It's great to be here today with all of you. Very exciting times.
If you will, for folks who don't know who you are, you're running for a statewide office. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. A little bit about myself. My name's Diana DeZoglio. I'm a senator from the Merrimack Valley. I was born to a 17-year-old single mother in the community that I currently actually reside in, the city of Methuen. We moved back and forth between Methuen and Lawrence throughout my childhood, depending on where my young mother could find work as a young nurse's aide. I went through the public school system here, graduated from our local community college, and then earned a seat at Wellesley College, where I was so grateful to attend, but I was only able to actually attend there because of a full financial scholarship that I had received. And the reason why I think it's important to mention that is because it really was due to those financial investments made into my future success that I was able to actually see some future success. And that inspired me to get in community service. I worked at various nonprofits through the years, working with teen survivors of domestic violence, working with inner city youth, helping to expand diversity, equity, and inclusion programming in my community. And I also simultaneously through these years, as many families do, Kevin, was working other jobs. I was waiting tables. I was running a small cleaning business and cleaning homes and office spaces throughout my community. You might love what you do as a day job, but it doesn't always pay the bills and afford you with the opportunity to live in the community that you're working in. So like many families across Massachusetts, I was juggling those positions. And it was during that time that I was offered a job working at the State House as a legislative aide on Beacon Hill. And though I had no idea what a state representative did at that time, I did know that I needed health insurance. So I went in for a job interview, and I got the job. And let me tell you something, it was like drinking water from a fire hose. I learned about all of the great things that our state legislature can do for our communities, from investing in early intervention for children, to public education and public higher education, to fighting for access to health care, for fighting against the negative impacts of climate change, making sure we have a robust transportation system. I could go on and on and on about all the great things I learned that our state legislature can do. But I also, during that very short amount of time, learned about the flip side of how our state government can operate. During that very short time, I was sexually harassed as a younger woman in my 20s. This was many years ago. And the way that it was thought appropriate to deal with that harassment was to require that I sign a taxpayer-funded, your dollars, taxpayer-funded non-disclosure agreement that prevented me from talking about anything that I'd seen, witnessed, or experienced behind those closed doors amongst Beacon Hill's most powerful politicians. But I didn't let them get rid of me or keep me quiet. And I didn't leave state government like they told me to do. I instead decided to run for state representative myself, and a little over a year later made my way back into that same chamber as the youngest woman serving in the House of Representatives at that time. And since then, Kevin and friends, I have fought tooth and nail to make sure that families like mine, working families in our communities, have the representation that they need up on Beacon Hill. Too many times we see that families have been disenfranchised or dismissed or ignored by systems in our state government and our state agencies that just aren't working for all families in Massachusetts the way that they could and the way that they should. I took on that battle regarding the abuse of those taxpayer-funded NDAs that silence workers about discrimination, harassment, and abuse of all kinds. And I'm happy to say that in the Senate, we've passed my bill to ban the use of those agreements across state government. But we have, unfortunately, some in state government who continue to dig their heels in on this simple matter of abuse of your tax dollars and on issues of transparency and accountability across the board. During the pandemic shutdown period, we remember when vaccines were taken and funneled to mass vaccination sites and to folks in the private sector with no bid, no RFP contracts in the millions of our tax dollars. As a senator during that time, I stood up and I demanded equitable access for our elderly, our disabled, our immunocompromised, those without transportation, for example. But I also demanded a full audit and an investigation into how much in our tax dollars was handed out to friends of the administration during that shutdown with no bid, no RFP contracts, because we deserve answers. When the Holyoke Soldiers Home tragedy occurred and we lost 77 veterans due to mismanagement at that home, I stood up as a senator and I called for a full investigation and audit into what happened, of course, for transparency and accountability, but more so because the families of those who lost those loved ones, those 77 veterans, they deserve the truth and they deserve justice. And just one more example. When McKinsey Consulting continued to be contracted with, despite the findings months ago, that they were actually guilty in helping Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family cover up their contributions to the opioid crisis by willingly lying about the addictive properties of their product, OxyContin. Our attorney general stood up and announced a lawsuit against McKinsey Consulting, but our state government continued to contract with this company. When that happened, I stood up as a senator and I demanded that we stop contracting with a company who's proven to abuse the public's trust time and time again and willingly contributed to the devastating impacts of the opioid crisis, which has devastated countless families across our communities, including mine and many of yours, those who are listening at home. As a state senator, I've been standing up, I've been speaking out, I've been legislating, I've been advocating. I've been calling for audits, I've been demanding investigations, but as your next state auditor, I won't need to keep calling for audits or demanding investigations. I will audit and I will investigate these matters and much more on your behalf, because we know that sunlight is the best disinfectant. And for as forward-thinking as Massachusetts is, our state government continues to be ranked as the least transparent state government in the entire nation, according to almost every single good government group. Friends, we can do better, but in order to do better, we're going to need to start shining a light in those dark areas of state government to expose what's going on, to find where the gaps are so that we can work together to fill those gaps so that all families can have a seat at the table, regardless of their bank balance, their family background, or their zip code.
Again, if you are just tuning in, we are speaking with State Senator Diana DeZoglio. I accidentally said Diane. That is erroneous. She is, again, running for state auditor. What is it about this particular office that you find appealing to want to campaign for higher office?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, as I just discussed, I've been a state senator. I've been a state representative. I've been a community advocate and, you know, leading programs in various nonprofits. I've done this work. I've been a small businesswoman. I've been, you know, somebody who's been actively engaged pretty much my entire life. And I think that, you know, when I think about this auditor's role, look, a lot of people in my community have asked me why I would ever leave being a senator to run for a position like auditor. And here's why. As auditor, I'll be able to effectuate the change that I have been calling for as a state senator. As a senator, I'm one out of 40 people who gets to take a vote at the state house on matters of importance regarding our shared values in our communities, making sure we have adequate funding for things like education, public safety, our councils on aging, our roads, our bridges, so on and so forth, right? And I can take a vote on making sure that we're holding our government agencies accountable in ensuring that those dollars are spent wisely, and also in making sure that we have processes and procedures that are effective for folks across the board. But the authority that I don't have is being able to actually go into those state agencies and audit them and produce reports that will shine a light on where we're falling short so that we can do better with the legislation that we're offering. So I will be able to have subpoena authority in that office to get access to information that otherwise may have been denied. I can't tell you how many times I've tried to get access to data points, percentages, how many times I've tried to get how much we're spending on particular programs and been denied that information from public agencies regarding our public tax dollars. Friends, that's unacceptable. As state auditor, I'll be able to get access to that information and make sure that as a result, you have access to that information as well, so that you can know what's going on regarding your tax dollars and then take appropriate action in contacting your legislators and the governor's office to ensure that you're advocating and talking about, you know, are able to talk about what you think about how your tax dollars are being spent. But you have to be able to get access to that information before you can take appropriate action, right? So I'm running to make sure that we expand access and opportunities, again, for all families in Massachusetts, regardless of their family background, bank balance, or zip code.
So I would ask you, how closely have you researched what the current state auditor, Suzanne Bump, has done during her time in office? What are some of the things that you'd look to build on or maybe even consider modifying?
Look, I think about, you know, regional equity, right? We hear a lot of times certain areas get attention more than others. Certain areas of the Commonwealth get more funding than others. And I can tell you as a state senator, that's actually been what I've seen to be the case. Unfortunately, we really need to do a lot more work on regional equity. Look, I come from the Merrimack Valley. We're on the New Hampshire border. I represent a lot of communities that are right on that border. And it's been extremely challenging to make sure that our community sees equity when it comes to getting its fair share of funding for roads and bridges, our schools, our local senior centers, our public safety department, so on and so forth. I could go on and on. And I know that regions like yours as well have had those challenges presented in making sure that you get your fair share. Something that the current state auditor did that I think that we need to continue to build upon, you know, she looked at the payment in lieu of taxes issue. It's called the PILOT program here in Massachusetts for short. PILOT, payment in lieu of taxes. And what the PILOT program is, it's essentially the state reimbursing cities and towns for land that the state takes up that city or town would have otherwise been able to have collected property taxes on, for example, right, through either commercial real estate or residential real estate. But the state has now taken it over, whether it's for, building purposes or whether it's for generally state reservations, and state parks are the easiest example I can give, right? A state park. So let's say there's a state park in your community. Your community is supposed to be getting paid by the state and reimbursed for the state to use that land because the city otherwise would have been able to see some revenue coming in for other purposes. And we're supposed to be funding those payments back to your community at appropriate levels. And they're supposed to be appropriate with regards to what the city would have been able to potentially gain from that land if they had used it otherwise. But what's happening, according to the report from the auditor's office, is that the state is shortchanging our communities, and significantly so. And her report outlined that, you know, there isn't equity when it comes to making sure that cities and towns are getting their fair share from the state. So I'd like to build upon that and do a deeper dive into what particular areas we are seeing lack of funding in. She did a report on transportation funding, for example, regarding Western Mass transportation, infrastructure, broadband, so on and so forth. And she showed how the current state formula actually doesn't benefit rural remote communities, for example, and that they're getting shortchanged and they're not seeing their fair share. So I think we need to do a lot more work on making sure that we're talking about specific subject areas. I'd love to look at education funding. I'd love to look at transportation funding, so on and so forth, and make sure that our communities are getting their fair share and build upon that great work.
How about something like the American Rescue Plan Act, ARPA funding? Is that something that if you're elected, you'd also want to keep an eye on, seeing that the distribution points is going to be over the next couple of years?
For sure, and thanks for bringing that up. Yes, as a senator, I voted for the ARPA spending plan and where those dollars would go. And one of the amendments that I co-sponsored in that debate was an amendment to require that we track how those dollars are being spent so that we can keep an eye on those dollars and make sure that there's accountability and that there's not just this free-for-all going on with the billions of dollars that's been released and gone through this process. As state auditor, I will build upon the work that I did as a state senator to require accountability, and I will make sure that our office is using every tool in the toolbox to monitor how those funds are being spent to make sure that there's transparency and that those dollars are not getting wasted, of course.
ARPA being, you know, the funding mechanism under the Biden administration because of COVID to help with infrastructure. Let's talk a little bit about COVID. How is COVID going to play a role regarding campaigning this year and deciding the next state auditor?
Yeah, you know, I mean, if we're talking about the campaign trail, I will just say, look, it's been challenging for every candidate across the board to get their message out there. We need to collect 5,000 signatures just to get on the ballot. And you can imagine how challenging that can be, you know, during a time when things are largely virtual, right, due to public health concerns. So, you know, certainly it's been a little bit different of a challenge than, you know, what you would expect without COVID at play. But look, this is the world that we're living in, and we're working hard, and we're going to get, you know, our signatures out, you know, we're going to get our nomination papers out there, and you'll see us on the campaign trail. We're going to do our very best under these circumstances. Safety first, public health first, you know, and those of us that are campaigning, we can find ways around it and get creative.
For the everyday voter who doesn't know what the auditor's office may necessarily know for a deep dive per se, what do you feel are going to be some of the issues that are going to better inform the voter when they go in to vote come September, I believe it's September 6th, and in November for the general election?
I'm sorry, you cut out for the first part of that, Kevin. I'm so sorry. What was the first part of the question?
So the first part of the question is for voters don't necessarily understand the full scope of what a lot of the offices are. Auditor, you know, they understand what the Attorney General is to a degree. For folks who don't necessarily know all that entails the auditor's office, what are going to be some of the key issues to better inform them for when they go in to vote for the primary and then the general election in November?
Yeah, look, the auditor's office, and I have to explain what the auditor's office does quite often. It's not really the highest profile position, right? It's definitely not the glamorous position. The auditor is the chief accountability officer for the state of Massachusetts. It is a watchdog role. And regardless of what issue is important to you, whether it's climate change, environmental justice, education, access to health care, a robust transportation system, making sure that we have access to great mental health services and that we're fighting against the disease of addiction, fighting for women's rights, fighting for social justice, all of these different things. And I could go on and on. No matter what the issue of importance is to you, why it's important to know what who the auditor is, who the candidates are, and why this role is important is because if we want to make meaningful change on any of those fronts, we need transparency and accountability first. We can't make meaningful progress on these issues up on Beacon Hill unless we know where we're starting from so that we can decide where we want to go from there. And right now, the challenge at Beacon Hill has been getting access to the data, again, regarding how much we actually have in these programs, regarding what's currently happening, and getting percentages about, you know, the different impacts of the different programs that we see, you know, happening across state government. I can tell you as a member of the Senate that I have fought and led the charge on transparency and accountability efforts within the legislature, fighting to make sure that we have at least 24 hours to read a bill, that we make all of our committee votes public, to make sure that we're subject to the public records law, and so isn't the administration. None of these things have passed yet. So business up on Beacon Hill is done largely behind closed doors and out of the eye of the public. Think about the fact that our state house has been closed now. We just had the 700 day anniversary of the state house being closed completely to the public. That's not even one constituent in the Commonwealth has had the opportunity to go in and to have a meeting with their state representative or with their senator. Now, this has been happening at a time when we have concerts taking place. We have sporting events happening. We had the State of the State address for the governor over at the Heinz Convention Center, but not at the State House where it normally is. That's not something that I think should be happening right now. You know, we certainly need to make sure that we are doing things in accordance with public health guidelines, and make sure that we have public health and public safety as the most paramount of issues to address. But at the same time, certainly, if we as those governing the state can allow for folks to have meetings in private businesses and in other areas and to congregate there, certainly we can find a way to open up the doors of the state house and make sure that we can take meetings with residents who have questions about what's going on in the people's house, regarding the people's business, regarding the people's tax dollars. And right now that hasn't been happening. So I've been pushing to open up the doors to make sure that folks can get access to what's going on behind those closed doors on Beacon Hill. And as state auditor, I will continue that work to make sure that we're opening up the process so that you can participate in what is supposed to be the democratic process up on Beacon Hill.
As auditor, your role will change when it comes to legislation being filed. But would you still want to be somehow, as an auditor, involved in the process when certain bills are being filed? And what kind of bills would you see yourself lending your office and your staff to perusing such bills and legislation?
Look, we talked about the NDA issue, right? I was given a non-disclosure agreement as a younger woman in my 20s through the Speaker of the House's office back then. And since then, I've been fighting to pass legislation, which we passed in the Senate, to ban the abuse of taxpayer-funded NDAs that cover up the misdeeds of powerful politicians and others across state government. While we've been able to, Kevin, get that through the Senate, that hasn't passed the House yet, and it still hasn't been signed off by the governor. So as state auditor, I plan in, for example, to go in and do a deep dive across our state agencies to find out how much in your tax dollars has been abused to silence government workers about abuse or potential corruption or harassment or discrimination that's going on in our state government, where your tax dollars are being able to be used to silence them about those abuses, to make sure that powerful perpetrators are protected. I'd like to know how much in our tax dollars has been spent on those types of agreements. Now, as state auditor, I'll be able to shine a light on that and do an audit and use my subpoena authority to get to the bottom and to get those of that issue and to get those answers. But I'm not running just to be your auditor. I'm running to continue to be your advocate. And I will be continuing to file legislation pertaining to, for example, that matter, to make sure that we're banning the abuse of your taxpayer dollars through the funding of non-disclosure agreements to silence victims across the board. So I'll be able to do a deep dive, use subpoena authority, get to the bottom of how those tax dollars are being abused, how, when, where, why, and then produce a report. And then I'm also able to still work on legislation and go into committee hearings and work with my colleagues in the legislature to ensure that we're taking action on the findings of my office. So yes, my experience in the legislature will absolutely be of great assistance when I hopefully, with your support, you know, that I humbly and respectfully request, that I will be able to take that work to the next level and make sure that I'm using my experience as a legislator to inform my work as a state auditor and then continue to advocate for bills passage.
If you're just tuning in, we are speaking with State Senator Diana DeZoglio. She is a candidate for state auditor. We have come to that time of our conversation where I ask you, is there something that we haven't discussed, but you'd like to take a moment to at least to talk about?
Yeah, I think when people think about the word auditor and the title auditor, that they think of counting beans. That's what I've heard from my friends and loved ones and supporters that have known me in my role of state auditor. And like I've said, they've asked, why would you ever leave being a senator to go count beans in a back room somewhere? Just want to reiterate that the role of the auditor, once again, is the watchdog role and the role of chief accountability officer. And we can do a lot more than just count how the tax dollars are being spent and where they're being spent. We can also look at processes and procedures in state government and how they have failed our children, our families, across the board, and make sure that we're working to fill the gaps that we identify. I'll give one example, Kevin. DCF, the Department of Children and Families. We saw that during the shutdown, during the pandemic, there was a child that was lost, that should not have been lost, that was found starved to death in his home. And he had some mental health challenges. He should not have been placed back in his home. The home was known to have been abusive. It was known by the Department of Children and Families that he had been abused in the home that they decided for some reason to put him back into. And because of that, we saw a tragic loss of life. Devastating. Those types of things cannot continue to occur in state government through state agencies that are tasked with protecting children in the Commonwealth. I will use my role as state auditor to make sure that we're doing a deep dive, not just into how the dollars are spent in programs like the Department of Children and Families, but that we're doing a full investigation into their processes and procedures so that those types of circumstances where children fall through the gaps and there is loss of life as a result, so that those things do not continue to occur. You know, so we need to make sure that we're taking deep dives into more than just the dollars, but into the processes and the procedures that are operating in our state government that can either cause tremendous harm or be of tremendous assistance. We should be of tremendous assistance, these state agencies, to families that are in need. That's what we're taxed with. That's what the mandate is, right? That's why you pay what you pay in taxes, is to make sure that these things are done correctly. So our office will go in and not just do, you know, efficiency audits and not just do the regular audits, making sure that things are functioning correctly at that time, but we'll also look at past circumstances like that to make sure we're analyzing where the agency may have gone wrong so that we can report on it. And again, work alongside of the legislature to file subsequent legislation to try to address the gaps in the system so that those types of tragedies don't take place again. And those types of things are what make me so passionate about this role. It's the opportunity to help families who need it most, to continue the work in the trenches to make sure that, again, all families have access, all families have opportunities, regardless of their bank balance, their family background, or their zip code.
Senator, last question, and that is, if folks want to find out more about your campaign, they want to get involved, where can they go to get that information?
Thanks so much. Great question. You can go to www.diana4ma.com. You can use the number four or the word four. We planned ahead here. So DianaForMA.com, and then you can email me at info@DianaForMA.com. That's Diana with one N. And then you can also call 978-984-7747. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We are on LinkedIn. If you just do a quick internet search as well, you can find out a lot about my background and my work in the legislature and also why I'm running for state auditor. And I hope that you'll do that. Look me up. find out more about me. And I do respectfully ask for your support and for your vote. I wish I could see you all in person. Obviously, in this age of COVID, that's not always the case. But I do just want to use this as an opportunity to say, I can't do this without you. I'd love to fight on behalf of all families in Massachusetts for a more transparent, accountable, and equitable state government. And I hope to have your support on September 6th, the day after Labor Day, September 6th in the Democratic primary. Thank you so much for having me here today.
Thank you again, Senator, for making yourself accessible so we can be able to have this conversation.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, everyone.
And with that, that is all the time that we have been given. Fear not, though. We will be back next week at 6:15 p.m. Until then, have a great evening.